Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Today's guest, Jeff Merkley, the junior senator from Oregon. Merkley's probably most famous politically for being the only Democratic senator to endorse Bernie Sanders last year. Well, that was last year, and now he's looking forward. Just got back from Iowa himself. That's right. Add him to that list of 2020 Democrats that gets longer and longer and longer, almost by the week. Here's the space that Merkley wants to be in, the pragmatic progressive. But not the Hillary Clinton version of that. Merkley is a full-blast, proud lefty, across the board on every issue, no moderation progressive. He's the guy who pushed for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act that would have fought workplace discrimination for LGBT people in the Senate. And he pushed hard on the Home Affordable Modification Program, which put in mortgage protections after the housing crisis. More recently, he's the guy who spoke for over 15 hours against the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. Technically, it wasn't a filibuster, and obviously it didn't work. But what I mean by pragmatic is that he's also the guy who, since last fall, when he thought his role was going to be pushing a President Hillary Clinton to the left on cabinet nominations, has been convening a small group of senators and activist groups in his office to get them working on strategy about how to actually get things done, bringing people together. It fits in with being an amateur engineer of sorts. As you'll hear, he built himself a wind turbine in his backyard. Naturally, it's now stuck in a tree. But now Merkley is a guy who's not willing to cede the ground on the left flank of the brewing Democratic presidential primary field to Sanders or to Elizabeth Warren or to anyone else. Check out the story I did on how this will all come together, or may, and what some of the other progressives make of him. That's up on our website at politico.com. Among the others I talked to about Merkley that you'll see in there, Jeff Weaver, the Sanders 2016 campaign manager, Ben Wickler from MoveOn.org, and Brian Schatz, the senator from Hawaii who's distinguishing himself as one of the chamber's leading liberals. Merkley and I sat down in his office in the Hart Building last week, just before he headed down to the big Medicare for All rollout that Bernie Sanders was doing one floor below. It was a really interesting conversation about the state of progressivism now and where it's going. Remember to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss any of the great guests coming up. Nancy Pelosi will be coming at you soon, and many more. Email me your thoughts and suggestions at isaac@politico.com and follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Isaac Dover. And now, my conversation with Jeff Merkley. Politicians only go to Iowa if they're running for president or if they want people to think that they might be running for president. Which category are you in? You were just there.
Well, it turns out if a progressive group invites you to come and speak, and it happens to be in Iowa, you go to Iowa as well. And I've been in Iowa, I've been in Pittsburgh, I've been in California, and I'll be a lot of other places as I work to advance progressive ideas and hopefully help a whole bunch of Democrats get elected.
But it's Iowa. You knew that that invitation is different from Pittsburgh or
well, I knew
ones.
It would create some rumors, and obviously, I guess
and
I was
you were
right.
Okay with that.
I was right about that.
When is the last time you were in Iowa? I was told it was a long time ago on your way to graduate school.
Yes, I was driving across the country in my 62 Falcon, and it just so happened that that's where my car broke down. Oh, that would have been 1980.
Okay, so 1980, you're in Des Moines, your car breaks down.
Yes, transmission goes out. So now this is the age in which cars had a lot of space, and that is you could get under the hood and work on them much simpler. And so having grown up as a son of a mechanic, I pretty well would repair everything myself. And so I went off to the junkyard and pulled a transmission out of a retired vehicle and proceeded to stick it in my car and continue on my way.
And you knew where the junkyard was?
That was called White Pages.
White Pages.
Yellow Pages. Remember those?
So long ago, right?
Yes.
I mean, I grew up in Manhattan. I didn't have a driver's license until after I had my bachelor's degree, so this is a very...
That's a different world.
Right before I got... I, in fact, drove to graduate school, but it was really my mother who did most of the driving, and we drove from New York to Chicago, but I didn't have my license until a week before that road trip, so it's a little different from your trip to grad school.
Very, very different.
And the tinkering has continued. Tell me about the wind turbine in your backyard.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, no, I get a desire to grab tools and make things. I grew up building mini bikes, and I raced quarter midgets. So we were always working on the cars, rebuilding the engines. And that continues. And so a couple years ago, I thought, you know, I wonder if you could get a large enough cross section with enough torque on it to be able to produce a usable amount, a very modest amount of energy without a high-speed rotation that would kill birds. And so I undertook to design a different type of wind turbine, and I'd be happy to show you some pictures of it later, turning away. And it turned for a summer in my backyard until a windstorm picked it up, and I was sitting in the living room. I was looking out the window, and I could see it rise up in the air and get thrashed to the ground.
And where is it now?
It's well, it's sitting between a couple fir trees in my backyard.
It's not. I was going to say there are not a lot of senators who come up with the idea of building a wind turbine and try to do it, but there are not a lot of people who do that. I would imagine that not a lot of your colleagues are sitting there thinking through wind turbine construction.
Probably not. No, that's probably right. Well, there's probably a fair number of folks in the Senate and House who come from a blue-collar background, who grew up building things, but not too many who still do it.
So why haven't you taken it out of the tree?
Well, life's complicated. I have to stick to simpler projects now, like rebuilding my deck or repairing my lawnmower and things like that.
But does that count as a success, the wind turbine project, or was it a failed project? I mean, it worked for a while, but now it's in a tree and is not
working. You know, I really enjoyed that summer watching it turn with this very slightest breeze you could not even feel. So I got a lot of enjoyment out of it. No patents pending at this point.
But nonetheless, to bring it back, it's 1980, your car breaks down in Des Moines, and you fix the transmission out of a junkyard. You are not there then for 37 years.
37.
So why shouldn't we think that this is the beginning of a presidential run?
Well, the cornfeed is a continuation of the steak fry, Tom Harkin's steak fry. Good, very good friends with Tom Harkin. The cornfeed called me up and asked if I'd come in and speak. I've been on the forefront of a lot of issues, taking on climate disruption with my Keeping the Ground bill and my 100x50 bill, taking on fairness for LGBTQ community with the Equality Act, being immersed in the funding side of through the Appropriations Committee, and I took on to lead the effort in the fight against the theft of a Supreme Court seat. So I think that combination is causing progressive groups to call me up and invite me to speak. And so I called Tom and asked him about the cornfeed. He said, oh, yeah, you should go talk to him. So I was happy to be invited and happy to speak to them.
Someone told me that there's somewhere inside you a little bit of regret about not running in 2016, that the thought is essentially you could have occupied some of that space on the left in a primary that Bernie Sanders ended up occupying. But it would have been a very different kind of race against Hillary Clinton, that she would have been challenged on a lot of issues, but maybe not damaged as much by Sanders as he did. Is that a fair assessment of where you are?
No, not at all.
No?
Not at all.
No,
I'm glad Bernie ran. I gave him all the support I could, endorsed him, assisted him. I'm so glad I think everyone felt that he would be a voice to contribute to the policy, wouldn't be a serious contender, but his authenticity, his passion, and his desire to make this economy work for working people, take on fundamental issues in a common sense way, it just absolutely connected. It was a home run effort, except, of course, he didn't win the right nomination, but it really had an impact far beyond anything that I think most people anticipated.
But wouldn't it have been better from your perspective to have a Hillary Clinton who has moved to the left but still ended up being President Hillary Clinton rather than President Donald Trump?
Well, I don't think the issue of Hillary Clinton losing the race has anything to do with Bernie Sanders. Yeah, Bernie worked.
She's
very
wrong.
Hard.
She's made that. She feels like that.
Well,
true.
I disagree with her. Yeah. I think the team that Bernie developed, he worked very hard, and many of us worked very hard to take that energy and help infuse it into Hillary's campaign. And I think in the end that was an assistance. But on some issues, she was clearly not connecting, and Donald Trump did some interesting things. For example, where he took the Democratic position, from the position many of us have as Democrats, and said these trade treaties, which give our competitors a huge advantage over American manufacturers, is absolutely crazy. And on this, I agree with Donald Trump 100%. And he made that passionate connection that if you're losing manufacturing jobs, if you're not making things in America, you're not going to have a middle class in America, and we need to reverse that. And he did that very effectively, often starting out his speeches on that. And on this particular issue, Hillary Clinton didn't get it, didn't understand how that issue affects ordinary people. It's an issue where I live in a blue-collar community. I see it. I tried to persuade her team that how important this was, and she lost in the industrial states largely on this issue.
I want to come back to something you said, which is you said that that the Sanders campaign infused a lot of energy into the Clinton campaign. If you play that out a little bit, do you think she would have done worse than if Sanders hadn't run? Is that because it's against her argument, right? Her argument is if Bernie Sanders hadn't beat me up so much, I would have been a stronger person in the general election.
I mean, there was Bernie during the debate giving her protection over one of her main vulnerabilities, which was her emails. Mm-hmm. And he helped defend her and say, no, set that issue aside. Let's talk about real issues.
And what about energy? I mean, is that do you think there are people who voted for her for her as a Democrat who wouldn't have been turned on to voting before the Sanders campaign?
Yeah, I think that there was a tremendous amount of grassroots energy that came into the general on behalf of the Democratic side from those who were coming out of the Sanders campaign.
You were the only person in the Senate to endorse him. How did your colleagues react to that? Did they give you a lot of guff for it?
They were a little puzzled why I would endorse someone when everyone knew Hillary would be our next president, and that you're therefore in a situation of offending the future president. But for me, it was a matter of endorsing the person who I felt was addressing in a thorough and passionate manner the key issues facing ordinary Americans. Now, in my community, my children went to the same public high school I did. I've seen that community now, I think, first moved there in 1963, and so I've seen it over five decades. And I can tell you the families today are having a much tougher time being able to find full-time jobs, a tougher time trying to find living wage jobs, a tougher time helping their kids find a path into a good job outside of college. And if their kids want to go to college, it's enormous financial danger zone in which they potentially, and many do, end up with large debts and no job and a millstone around their neck. And finally, absolutely tougher in terms of buying a home. And so for many families, they're simply hoping to become a homeowner by virtue of inheriting it from their parents. But their parents on blue-collar jobs were able to buy those homes.
So did Hillary chase you down for the endorsement, or did she assume that you'd give it like everybody else in the Senate did?
No, she didn't. She didn't call. She didn't chase me down. No, she didn't call me. No,
but Bernie was calling you.
Bernie eventually did call me. Yes,
eventually
he did. He did call and ask. I think I would have endorsed him if he hadn't asked.
Really?
But yeah, I think so.
That's interesting. It does seem like one of the things that it did was give you some credibility to convene these meetings that you've been having of progressive activists, of progressive senators, and some who are not necessarily known for being progressives. We're sitting in your Senate office. This is where it happens, right? They bring people in here?
Yes. Yes. And the argument I'm making is to be effective, you have to have an outside grassroots movement, and you need to have team members inside the elected body. And that combination of that inside-outside effort makes you much more effective. If we here in this building, here in the Senate, don't understand what the grassroots organizations are cooking up and planning to do, and if they don't understand our strategy, the two can really work at cross purposes. And I think the two came together in a magnificent way in defeating President Trump's wealth care plan to devastate health care and increase the wealth of the richest Americans.
So who's on that invite list?
Well, it's groups. I'll just give you some examples,
sure,
without giving the whole list, but it's groups like Move On, Credo, Our Revolution, and so forth.
And of the senators?
I'll leave that, their privacy, to themselves.
Elizabeth Warren has been in here. Brian Schatz from Hawaii has been in here, right? People like that?
I think
that.
You're on the right track.
do you Can any senator from the Democratic caucus come, or is it you are deciding who they are?
Well, no one has been turned away.
Are people, what are those meetings like? Bernie Sanders has come to some of them, right?
Yeah, you know, and often there's team members. I just don't want to, I don't think it's fair. This is to say who's coming and who isn't. It's folks who buy into this philosophy of this inside-outside connection, want to understand what these groups are, want to contribute ideas to them, have them contribute ideas to us, make sure we're as effective as possible.
Are they cordial conversations? Are they? Do they get heated? The energy that is there among the Democratic base is intense, but it's also a lot of, at least in this stage of it, sort of infighting, questions about litmus tests and purity and who is giving up and who's giving in and who's staying with the way things should be.
They're passionate, but they haven't been heated in terms of friction. This has been all about building teamwork, and it seems to have been very much appreciated both by the Senate side of that equation and on the grassroots side.
And do you feel like you're coming out of them with action plans a lot of the time, or is it more it's good to have people in the room? Because we hear that all the time about Washington. People just aren't talking. And that's true among Republicans and Democrats. It's true among Democrats with each other. It certainly seems to be true among the activist groups, whether you're talking about Republican-leaning ones or Democratic-leaning ones. But do you feel like you're coming out of this and like, okay, these are what we're going to do this next week?
Sometimes it's very specific. For example, yes, we're going to go out and hold a rally on the steps, and we're going to do it this time in this place. If you all want to publicize it, that'd be wonderful. If you want to show up, be great. But often it's pondering strategy. What way of communicating about an issue will be effective in moving people to stay involved, to be involved, to accentuate their level of commitment.
Would you want moderates here? Like, would you want this to be every Democratic senator here? Or does that make it ineffective?
Well, I think this effort, because we're so busy, is most effective. A few senators take the time to be this dialogue, and then we're able to communicate with our leadership team. We're able to communicate with the rest of the caucus. One of the things that came out of these conversations would be great to have someone on Senator Schumer's staff who's mm-hmm. really working directly to communicate with these groups. He did that. That's just another example of increasing the level of teamwork, partnership, cooperation.
How has Trump changed what progressivism is and how progressives focus on things? I was talking to a leader of one of the big unions who said to me, it's clarifying in a way from that person's perspective. Has it changed the way you think about any of these issues? You've been pushing on a lot of these issues for a long time before anybody thought that Donald Trump was going to actually run for president. But has it changed the approach? Has it changed the emphasis on any of things?
I'll tell you, Trump is such a mystery. And when I say that, he campaigned on draining the swamp. And then he puts Wall Street in charge of our economy. He proceeds to put the fossil fuel industry in charge of the environment. He hasn't drained the swamp. He's doubled the size of it, and he's filled it with swamp monsters. He's taken public education, which is absolutely cherished by working people, and he's put somebody in charge who hates public education, who never went to public education. Children didn't go to public education, didn't volunteer in a public school, didn't teach in a public school, and yet has been ranting about education, knowing nothing about it, and suddenly is in charge of it? Are you kidding me? Let me tell you how powerful the public schools are. My father said to me, you go through the doors of that schoolhouse and you work hard and you can do just about anything because we live here in America. He was so proud that our country together had built these great public schools that gave everybody a chance to thrive. And those schools are being diminished, underfunded, and with people like Betsy DeVos torn apart.
But you say mystery. What you're describing, and the examples you said are essentially hypocritical things, right? Which is something that people who attacked President Trump point to. So you don't really mean mystery, right? You don't think he's a mystery, do you?
Well, I do think that it was a surprise that he was able to campaign on one vision and implement a completely different vision. He attacked Hillary for being too close to Wall Street. Well, he wakes up every day seeing what he can do for Wall Street, how he can tear down consumer protections.
Were you legitimately surprised by that? Or were you one of the people who, and there were a lot of Democrats who felt this way, that he was not being honest during the election?
I was surprised about the Wall Street piece. I wasn't surprised about the environmental side because the Koch brothers fossil fuel industry now own the Republican Party. You can see since Citizens United allowed billionaires to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in campaigns, and they did so in 2014. They did so in Louisiana, in Arkansas, in North Carolina, in Iowa, in Colorado, in Alaska. They won all those races. And then they immediately, as those new Republican senators are just trying to find their desk on the Senate floor, they announced in the next election, we're going to spend the better part of $1 billion. From that point forward, it's been the Koch brothers say to the Republican leadership, jump, and the Republican leadership says, how high? And that led to the theft of a Supreme Court seat, among other things.
One of the people you are familiar with is a guy named Gordon Smith, who you beat for the Senate seat that you now hold. He was notably a Republican moderate. There are not a lot of Republican moderates left. I know that you don't want Gordon Smith to be in that Senate seat because then you wouldn't be in it. But do you think that that's a problem, that we are at this point where moderates are not able to function really in Congress anymore, whether they're Republican moderates or Democratic moderates? You see, just in the last couple of weeks, a few Republican moderates in the House who have said that they're done. Charlie Dent is probably the most prominent of those.
Here's the enormous challenge we face, and that is that our media empire is broken into two completely separate worlds. Now, because I do a town hall in every county, because most of those counties are Republican counties, I hear what's been on Fox News. I hear what Rush Limbaugh is talking about. And plus, I switch back and forth in the channels to see what's going on. Think about how different this world is from the Congress we had back in 1976 when I was first an intern here. At that point, most of the senators had served in World War II together. They were on the same team. They were on Team America. They had different views, perhaps a little bit about taxation, a little bit about regulation, but their views crossed over substantially, and they certainly didn't demonize each other. Plus, they worked here all week long. They had a normal work week. They returned home once a month, so they had weekends. They socialized. The friendships were deeper. And we had three networks that were bringing the national conversation together. Well, now we have these divided worlds where they spin out a completely different story, and each side is essentially saying, look at that other tribe. That other tribe is destroying America. We have to stop them.
So we don't have everybody on Team America in Congress anymore?
Well, unfortunately, it's more like the blue team and the red team.
And not Team America.
Well, I believe that the blue team is Team America.
Surprised to hear you say that.
I know, I'm shocked. I shocked you with that one.
There is a sense, I think, in the general conversation that the kind of left lane of the Senate and potentially of a 2020 presidential field is occupied by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Do you think that that is an oversimplification? You must, right? You want to be in that lane too.
Well, no, I'm not running for anything. I'm helping out people win in 2018. I've always felt like you throw yourself into battles that matter. And I'm all about a teamwork. That's the way I ran nonprofits, Habitat for Humanity, the World Affairs Council, developed affordable housing, started IDA program, the first individual development account program west of the Mississippi. Build a team. And that's what I did as speaker, led in Oregon, led to the most effective session in a generation. There are folks who partner or operate through intimidation, anger. I come completely from the team building side, and I'm going to fight for the things I believe in. If that happened to lead to a situation to do anything different than I'm doing now, which I'm very happy with what I'm doing right now, we'll let that come when the time comes. But I'm doing everything I can to help my colleagues 25 of whom are running out of the 33 seats, hold those seats.
Are you going to go campaign for them across the country?
I am indeed.
That's the kind of move that people who are interested in running for
president
do.
I have the advantage now that my children are out of high school. They're off to college now, so I have more flexibility than I've had before to be able to travel the country and help people out.
But focused on the Senate business of it, do you think, for example, that it's a big deal that Elizabeth Warren voted for Ben Carson? Was that a mistake?
Oh, listen, I'll let you talk to Elizabeth Warren about that. I don't see the point in picking any single vote or criticizing people for it. Realize, you know, Elizabeth Warren came here to talk to me when I was a freshman senator. And this is a story she would tell you. She went to office after office. She met with senators. They said, Elizabeth, it's a great idea, that Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She came to my office.
It's like the beginning of 2009.
2009, yes. And she came to my office, and I said, it's a terrific idea. I've been immersed in fighting predatory lending. Let's make it happen. And I just threw myself into that effort. And it was a condition when Senator Dodd wanted me to endorse Dodd-Frank. I said, well, I've got a list of things that have to be in it. And he had worked to get me on the committee specifically to help take on predatory lending, because I kept speaking in caucus about the damage these teaser rate loans and these liar loans were doing to working Americans. Let me give you an example. When I went to celebrate the 1,000th house that Habitat for Humanity had built in Oregon, I was aware that tens of thousands of people had lost their homes because of predatory mortgages. That's what we had to stop. And so that was something I just focused on to make sure that we created the CFPB and that we took on and ended these predatory mortgage loans.
There is a sense that I've heard from some people who like the idea of you running for president, and I know that you're not committing to that, that you are you've been active on a lot of issues, on progressive issues, whereas someone like Warren, to just use an example here, has only distinguished herself mostly as a financial progressive on issues like that. Do you think that that's a fair thing for people to be thinking?
No, I think it's unfair. I think Elizabeth and Bernie have both been involved in a whole range of things that we would call fighting for ordinary Americans, fighting for progress, being a progressive. It's so wonderful to have them both here in the Senate.
Someone was actually telling me this morning about you predicting the housing crisis, you, to them at the early 2008, so before it happened. Is that fair?
Well, the housing crisis was already well underway in 2008. So
why didn't you get into the stock market, do some shorting, make some money?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that anyone in 2008 could. I mean, listen, in 2008, when I was visiting New York City to campaign, every time I was there, another company was melting down. I'd go in to talk to people, and their eyes would be, you know, just focused on the television or the computer screen, because everything was collapsing. I think I probably had a much better understanding of what was going on, because before that, I had fought to get a bill passed in Oregon to end those predatory loans. And I knew that those loans were not only with their liar loans, so people didn't have the money to pay them, or they had interest rates that after 2 years doubled, and you couldn't refinance the loan because they had prepayment penalties. I knew that those things were diabolical, that they would lead to bankruptcies. I knew that the families that could pay $700 a month or $600 a month couldn't pay $1,200 a month. So I was very aware we were setting up not just disaster for those families, but also for the financial markets. And then it unfolded more dramatically than I think probably anybody anticipated.
Let me ask you about predictions on a totally different front. You are just back from the Korean DMZ. You were there with a couple of your colleagues. You're right up there with in that room, right, where the North Koreans are looking
at
you.
Yes, there's three Quonset huts painted blue. That half of the hut is on the U.S. South Korean side, and half on the North Korean side.
And what is that experience like when you're in there? Because the North Koreans know you're there, right, and they are looking at you.
Yes, picture that there's a big South Korean building and a North Korean building and a big valley in between. And at the bottom of that valley, there's a 17-inch wide strip of concrete that separates the two sides. Then you have three Quonset huts that are oriented north-south. So
what's a Quonset hut for the people that
don't? So this is a Marine hut from, I believe, from World War II. They're just a basic building that was used to house Marines as barracks, and I heard them described as Quonset huts. I'm not sure technically if they stem from that period or not, but very simple framework buildings, three of them to hold negotiations between the North and South. So when you go into one of those blue buildings and you go to the end of the room, you're actually standing in North Korea. And the North Korean soldiers come down the steps of their big building into this valley with their movie camera, three soldiers, one in the middle with their movie camera. They come and they go to the window on the North Korean side and take movies of you inside, which caused us to think that'd be a really cool picture for us to take. So we quickly assembled against the wall so we could get a picture of us with the North Korean soldier taking camera movies of us at the same time.
But so it's you and Senator Markey from Massachusetts and Senator
Chris Van Hollen.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, we then went to the border between China and North Korea, Dandong. And this is a place where there are three bridges. And this tells you a lot. One bridge, called the Broken Bridge, has never been repaired on the North Korean side. So it's still broken. And now it's kind of a monument to the Chinese intervention in the Korean War. The second one is the one they did repair. But having repaired only one bridge, it's one lane of traffic, one lane of rail. And therefore, in the morning, it takes goods from North Korea to China. In the afternoon, about 3 o'clock, they reverse it. It's from China to North Korea. And so this very kind of minimal connection. And the third bridge is called the New Bridge. It's a massive, gorgeous, multi-lane highway, big suspension bridge, beautiful. Anybody in the world would be proud to have it. And there's not a single car or truck on it because the North Koreans decided they weren't going to complete the connection to the road on the North Korean side. So like 50 feet missing because they were afraid of too much Chinese influence and too much Chinese mm-hmm. connection. So this beautiful arterial, totally unused.
And when you're in the Quonset hut, do the North Koreans say anything to you, or they're just holding the big camera?
No, they don't say a word. And there is a hotline between South Korea and North Korea. The North Koreans don't answer it. So actually, when there's conversations or a communication that the folks want to occur, the South Koreans actually go down. And previously, they were using a bullhorn to say, "Hey, hey, you soldiers up there on the other hill. Convey this information."
So did they say, "Hey, here we come with Jeff Merkley"? Or
no need to announce for us. But I'm sure they were wondering who this delegation was that was arriving.
And now you're a star probably of North Korean television and maybe movies.
Well, there we
right?
go. I'm sure they analyzed who were these people, figured it out.
Did you come back more worried or less worried about the prospect of things getting out of hand in the Korean Peninsula?
I was worried when I went, and I'm even more worried now. We have to have a very consistent policy to address this issue. We haven't. We've talked military. We've talked economic pressure. We've talked dialogue. We've been all over the map. We've said we don't want to knock out their leadership. And then the head of our CIA said we do want to knock out their leadership. So we've had just a completely uncoordinated policy. Let me explain how difficult this is. We can push on the military side. But the North Koreans have the ability to aim hundreds of artillery against Seoul. They can kill tens of thousands within hours, maybe higher than that, maybe hundreds of thousands. 25 million people live in the vicinity of Seoul and can be hit by artillery. Plus, they have nuclear weapons.
Right.
And while they may not have a missile that can deliver it, there may be one of those warheads sitting in a boat in the Philippines right now, waiting to find its way to the U.S. In other words, the uncertainty of how they might use those warheads. The idea of a preemptive strike that can eliminate that threat is a crazy notion. The North Koreans are certainly doing all they can to make sure that that could not happen. Meanwhile, we have economic pressure. The challenge here is they are adopting North Koreans, and we talked to a high-level defector who basically said, imagine Pakistan, when India got a nuclear weapon, the leader of Pakistan said, "We will eat grass if necessary for a generation in order to acquire a nuclear weapon." That's the mentality of the supreme leader of North Korea.
So if President Trump called you into his office, into the Oval Office, to talk about this, and you have 30 seconds to say to him, "Here's what I came back from that Quonset hut thinking about North Korea," what is it that you say to him right
then? I'd say partner with China.
And about what you want him to do, right?
You bet. I would say, President Trump, our best bet is to partner with China to have a series of things we will do if they test another nuclear weapon or another long-range missile. Those have to include returning all the North Koreans who are abroad working for currency, 80% of which their wages goes to the government of North Korea. Every one of them will be sent home from around the world. Second of all the children of the elite of North Korea who they really care about having them study abroad, every single student visa will be rejected. A third thing that will happen, China will turn off the oil and shut down the bridge. Fourth thing that will happen, the U.S. will consider making sure that there's no ship traffic coming into North Korea. And then finally, we'll use everything else possible to essentially create animosity and tension among the elite about the future of the country so that there is some kind of either agreement to, A, stop their testing, come to the table, testing missiles and warheads. But it has to be coordinated with China. Simply saying you can't do it by essentially beating China up because their pride is going to be, well, then you're trying to show us who's top dog in the world. Nobody tells the Chinese what to do. It has to be a partnership.
You were there right after the president said the fire and fury threat, right?
Shortly thereafter.
So if you were to say to him, here's how that landed in the ears of Korea, from in South Korea and from your sense, obviously you weren't beyond standing on that concrete part in North Korea, but from being there, and you want to say to him, here's what to think of the way that the response to that was, what would it be?
I think that what the North Koreans probably heard, and I realize other than speaking to North Korean defectors,
right. This
is not a conversation with the North Korean government, but through the eyes of the experts we talked to the region, the folks in Japan, in South Korea, in China, the defectors from North Korea, the response would have been that language reinforced the argument that Kim Jong-un is making to his own population, which is that the U.S. wants to destroy North Korea, that they have to put all their resources into the military side, that they have to have nuclear weapons in order to deter America from bombing them.
Let's turn back to an easier topic that I'll press you on. Let's do a little more presidential election stuff. Bernie Sanders is going to be 78 in 2020. Is that too old to run for president?
Not at all.
Do you think he needs to make a decision at a point in this process that's earlier out so that everybody else knows who's going to potentially be running?
No, Bernie Sanders is his own person. He'll decide whether he wants to run or not. I think people should let him make that decision and accordingly.
Even if he goes into 2019 not saying whether he's in or out?
Listen, let me just explain to you how focused I am on helping my colleagues for 2018.
you have explained, but you were in Iowa, and people. I'm not the only person who has brought this question up to you, and I know it's come through your head too. And the question that I guess there's that old joke about every senator looks in the mirror in the morning and sees the president. You've done a lot of things that people thought were not likely to happen, right? You were a nuclear weapons analyst and had run Habitat for Humanity. Then you run for state rep in Oregon, and you won that. And then you're Speaker of the Oregon House in very short order. And then you got yourself elected to the Senate. And notably, you were one of the senators who was reelected, one of the Democratic senators who was reelected in 2014, which is not a long list. So do you ever think of yourself sitting behind that Resolute desk and say, President Jeff Merkley?
Well, I tell you, that is the furthest thing from my mind. I think there is a pattern to my life, though, that you've touched on. When I was in high school, a member of the very popular kids club came to me and said, I'm running for student body president. And this is somebody who had been president of our class or so forth since junior high. And I was a nerd. I was a math science nerd.
I'm shocked to hear that as somebody built a wind turbine.
And so he says to me, can you sign my petition? I said, yes, but you better treat me very well or maybe I'll run against you, which was, of course, a total joke because of the fact that nobody from the Math Science Study Center ever thought about running for student body president. And he laughed and he said, oh, someone like you would never have a chance. And I was like, that is so outrageous. Why do we elect the same people who get nothing done? They don't run a better food drive. They don't have better events. They don't help address the issue of kids getting expelled for smoking. They don't do anything. Why do we elect them? And so I marched down to the student activity office, got a petition, went down to my friends in the Mass Science Center and said, I'm going to run. And they all laughed. They laughed probably more than Mike Meadows did. And
I still remember his name.
I still do. I got my petition signed and I ran, and it was a multi-party race, and I won on the first ballot.
A multi-party? You mean
a multi-person, multi-candidate race? Yeah, there were three of us. I think three or four.
Even in Oregon, a multi-party student council
election. I still got 50% on that first ballot, and then I went about getting a whole group of folks to run for the remaining offices so that when I became student body president half a year out, I would have a whole team of folks who were competent planners, operators, and so forth. And, you know, it's parallel in a way to I ran the first time for the state legislature. I was running against two former state representatives. Folks said you can't win, you won't be able to raise money because they've been there, they know how to do this. And while they were pounding on lawn signs, I was pounding on doors, and I won nearly 50% of the vote, I think 49% in a four-way race. And when I ran to be the leader of my caucus, my friends in the caucus, in the House caucus, said, Jeff, are you kidding me? The leadership's all lined up for who will replace the current leader who is stepping down. You don't have a chance to win this. And I said, I know, but you know what? We will be in the minority forever if we don't change a whole bunch of things. And I've been building organizations, building Habitat for Humanity, building the World Affairs Council. We have to build this organization. We have to do it as a team. And therefore, I have something to say, so I'm going to run. And miraculously, in a very evenly balanced three-way contest, I won by a vote. And so it's like, if I believe that something matters, I'll throw myself into it, and I'm okay losing. But when you throw yourself in with that attitude and you're all about teamwork, sometimes you win. And that's happened.
So repeatedly. You're running for president.
No. Just explaining to you that the pattern you referred to is I'm willing to take on battles that I feel are important.
And there's
willing
not
to take on Wall Street and get the Volcker Rule passed to shut down Wall Street. How's this blue-collar kid from Oregon taking on the most powerful force on the planet and beating them in the course? It's because a team member came to me and said, you know, the gambling machine in Wall Street doesn't make any sense to have inside banks. Let that happen in wealth management funds.
But you're not going to, whatever your decision is, it won't be dictated by the thought of, oh, there's a lane for someone on the left of the field, and that lane is either Warren or Sanders or whoever. Like, it's one person gets into that lane. That won't be what guides your decision here.
I'll tell you, if I felt that something really matters and things need to be fought for, I might throw myself into that battle if I feel others are fighting for it. Might well decide that I'll do something else that matters. You know, until running for the Senate, when you have a six-year kind of position lined up, I'd always lived my life saying kind of every 2 years, is what I'm doing the best way I can use the brief number of years I have on this planet to fight to make the world a better place? And that caused me to change jobs and strategies. I worked on public policy from inside the Secretary of Defense's mm-hmm. office, working for Congress in a think tank on nuclear weapons. I thought I was going to work in the third world on third world economic development. I worked in villages in Mexico and lived in West Africa and worked a summer in India. But I switched to nuclear side because the biggest threat to the planet was at that time the tension between the then Soviet Union, the United States, and the hair trigger on nuclear weapons. Now I feel the biggest threat to the planet is runaway climate disruption. And we absolutely are losing that race. You see it all over Oregon in terms of the pine beetles doing well and the trees dying. The billion oysters died in 2008 because the Pacific Ocean is 30% more acidic than it was before the Industrial Revolution. Our trout streams are smaller and warmer, and our fire season is 2 months longer, and right now the entire state is aflame. And we have a responsibility. This is the biggest test Climate disruption is the biggest test human race has ever faced on this planet. And right now we're losing. We've got to take it on.
From your perspective, biggest threat or on threats to the planet, threats to the country, where does Donald Trump fall?
Donald Trump is very scary. We have a country that celebrated a pathway for all citizens from many backgrounds to be together. Our Pledge of Allegiance talks about one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. We have a president who thrives on driving division. My mother's, one of her principles was never try to get ahead by standing on top of other people. And I don't mean standing on shoulders, I mean stepping on them. Never try to get ahead by stepping on others. Donald Trump has lived his whole life stepping on others. He was raised to step on others. He cheated his subcontractors. He undermined everyone around him for his personal benefit. And to have a man who has little understanding of international affairs with his finger on the nuclear trigger, completely unacceptable.
Last question. Are you a Portlandia fan?
Well, yes. Aren't we all? Are you a fan?
I haven't watched all of the episodes.
You've got to watch the famous episode where they sit down and try to have a chicken dinner, and they want to know where the chicken came from.
I've seen that one.
Yes, that's the most famous one. And they finally got to go out there and kind of find out what it was named and how it was treated.
So is it an accurate description of your Portland constituents?
No, it's not an accurate description. But we do have an expression, keep Portland weird.
Yeah.
We celebrate diversity and innovation. It's a wonderful place. People are coming from all over the country to come to Oregon and to Portland because of the reputation of the incredible beauty of the state, the openness of the state, and certainly... that reputation is well deserved. It's paradise. If you visit, you'll probably stay.
I have visited.
And you left?
I left. I did
and you
leave.
Left.
I know.
But you're yearning to get back.
Yeah, if only for a voodoo donut.
So. Okay, there we go.
All right, Senator Jeff Merkley, thanks for taking the time.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Right. That was Senator Jeff Merkley. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy. Have you hit subscribe yet? Have you told a friend to subscribe yet? Make sure you do. You don't want to miss an episode. Catch you next time on Off Message.